coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Ukraine's military says it cannot begin withdrawing heavy weapons from the front lines in the country's east in accordance with a ceasefire deal because pro-Russian rebels are still carrying out attacks. Officials said Monday there can be no talk of withdrawing weapons as long as the attacks continue. On Sunday, both sides agreed to withdraw their heavy weapons from the front lines, a positive sign for the implementation of a peace plan that has been violated repeatedly. Military officials said the rebels agreed to complete the withdrawal over the next 2 weeks. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif met for a second day Monday for talks on Iran's nuclear program as a deadline for reaching an interim agreement creeps closer. U.S. and Iranian negotiators have been meeting since Friday in an attempt to resolve ongoing technical disputes, standing in the way of a comprehensive deal between Iran and a group of six world powers. The two sides have given themselves until March 24th to reach a framework agreement, with a July 1st deadline for a permanent deal. New U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter is holding talks in Kuwait with top U.S. commanders and diplomats on U.S. efforts to fight the Islamic State group. Carter flew to Kuwait City from Afghanistan to chair the meeting at the U.S. Army base there. In addition to military officers, U.S. ambassadors from Jordan and elsewhere in the Middle East are participating in these talks. Kuwait hosts U.S. and coalition military forces as they conduct daily raids on militant targets in Iraq and Syria. This is VOA News. French authorities say they have blocked six citizens imminently headed to Syria from leaving the country under a new anti-terrorism law designed to curb the flow of foreign fighters to militant groups abroad. The French Interior Ministry says the would-be travelers' passports were confiscated and an additional 40 administrative interdictions are being prepared. Under the law, the citizens' passports and ID cards will be held for 6 months. The government reserves the right to renew the order to keep the documents for longer. Hundreds of French citizens are believed to be fighting with militant groups, including the Islamic State in Syria. Greek officials worked Monday to complete economic reform proposals due to their European creditors by the end of the day as part of a deal to extend the Athens bailout for 4 months. Last week, European finance ministers gave Greece the Monday deadline to present proposals that would convince the country's creditors to grant the 4-month extension. The 19 European finance ministers in the euro currency bloc are to consider the Greek plan Tuesday. The proposals are aimed at reviving the country's faltering economy and cutting government spending. A Liberian health ministry official said the country will continue to observe all Ebola preventive protocols and regulations until it achieves zero infections. This came as President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf Sunday ordered the lifting of the nationwide Ebola curfew put in place August to prevent the further spread of the virus. Sirleaf also ordered the opening of the country's borders with its West African neighbors. Two shopping malls, one in the United States, the other in Canada, are operating with higher security measures following a terrorist threat made by Somali-based Islamist militants. The Mall of America in Minnesota and the Edmonton Mall in Canada both issued statements saying they were increasing security after Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab released a video Saturday appearing to call for cutbacks on Western shopping malls. U.S. President Barack Obama says a partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security would have a direct impact on the economy as well as national security. Speaking to a state governor's meeting at the White House, Mr. Obama said a partial shutdown of the agency would mean more than 100,000 Border Patrol, port inspection, and airport security agents would be left without a paycheck. The agency's $40 billion budget is set to run out this week because of a political dispute over immigration. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The number of Nigerian refugees fleeing to Cameroon to escape Boko Haram terrorism has doubled within the past month. The refugee population has grown from 20,000 to 40,000 in 21 days.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from the refugee camp on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. Details coming up. Also in the news, a young girl detonated a bomb in a Nigerian town yesterday, killing four and wounding as many as 46 others. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, two shopping malls, one in the United States and the other in Canada, are operating with higher security measures following a terrorist threat met by Somali-based Islamist militants. The Mall of America in the northern U.S. state of Minnesota and the Edmonton Mall in Edmonton, Canada, both issued statements saying they were increasing security after Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab released a video Saturday appearing to call for attacks on Western shopping malls. The terrorist threat specifically mentioned shopping areas in the United States, Canada, and Britain. Yesterday, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said authorities are taking the threat seriously. He said the global terrorist threat has evolved into militant groups publicly calling for independent actors in their homelands to carry out attacks. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for a September 2013 terrorist attack that killed 67 people at the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya. A young girl detonated a bomb in the Nigerian town of Potiskum yesterday, killing four and wounding as many as 46 others. Survivors say the girl was about 8 to 10 years old, leading some to fear that children abducted by Boko Haram militants are being used as suicide bombers. Meanwhile, there are increasing news reports that the Nigerian military, with the help of government forces from Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, are taking northeastern towns that have been occupied by Boko Haram for many months. The Nigerian military claims they have retaken the town of Baga and a military barracks near Lake Chad. Baga was overrun by Boko Haram fighters in January. However, a message on Twitter from Al-Urwa Al-Wutka, a media division formed by Boko Haram last month, claims the town remains under the control of Boko Haram. Neither claim can be independently confirmed at this time. The number of Nigerian refugees fleeing to Cameroon to escape Boko Haram terrorism has doubled within the past month. Reporter Moki Edwin Kinzeka visited the refugee camp in Minawao on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, where the refugee population has grown from 20,000 to 40,000 in 21 days. And he reports that a humanitarian crisis is looming.
Where is his senior brother?
He said, after when he registered, he ran.
UN refugee agency staff take a roll call of Nigerians arriving here at Minawao refugee camp. The coordinator of UN systems in Cameroon, Najat Rushdie, says the number of refugees has almost doubled.
L'arrivée des réfugiés dans les villages pose aussi des problèmes supplémentaires en matière d'eau.
She says the massive arrival of refugees in villages poses problems of water, health and education, and they have to act immediately to support the host communities to improve their health situations and give them water. She says the pressure is high for the host communities. Among the recent arrivals at Minawao is 41-year-old Muhammadu Usman, the oldest brother in a family of 14, who says he lost all of his siblings when they turned down recruitment offers from the Nigerian militants group.
They kill my brothers, or the Boko Haram, they will come and attack you. Are you generous? When you say no, they will kill you. My mother just advised me to go. I told her, when I go, who can give me food? She said, no, I should go.
Usman is a Muslim, and his presence in the camp is not appreciated by Christians, who say they underwent physical and psychological torture in Nigeria in the hands of people who said they were Muslims. Elias Yeager, a Catholic Christian, says they have been asking Cameroon security forces to be watchful of all Muslims in the camp.
They combine us, both Muslim and Christian. But sometimes we got problem because we call them Boko Haram sometimes. They will catch them and carry to the security here.
Last week, the Cameroonian forces arrested hundreds of the refugees, saying they were suspected Boko Haram fighters who had infiltrated the camp. Yeager says life has been extremely difficult for him and his family for the 1 week he has been here.
I brought my family on. My wife is in market. My children, they are from school. They give us food normally, but the feeding will not satisfy us. That's why they call us here today in meeting. So maybe tomorrow they will give us the feeding. We eat 2 times in the day. According to the feed way they give us, we cook it in our various our houses.
Muhammad Buka, a cattle rancher who fled from Yerwa, Borno State, says he is thankful to God for saving his life from the insurgents, but says the increasing number of Nigerians in the refugee camp is making living conditions unbearable.
Unfortunately, day by day, people are coming. The population is increasing. There is no water. There is no place of toilet. We are just dumping anyhow. Now, in this camp, about 15 days, we didn't get our food. All of us now, we are in hunger. Now, we are just hanging around.
Najat Rushdie of the UN system in Cameroon says a humanitarian crisis is looming with the influx of refugees.
Nous voulons vraiment, vraiment vider Kolofata au plus tard mardi pour enlever les.
She says that with the help of Cameroon's military and local authorities, they are about to transfer 5,500 refugees who are at Kolofata to Minawau. Rajji says the plan is to transfer between 750 and 1,000 per day, and that in 2 days, they already transferred 1,200 refugees to Minawau. Some international bodies have promised to help the refugees. Jean-Louis de Broer, Director of Operations for the European Union's Humanitarian Aid and Civil Protection Office, says they will double their assistance to the refugees this year to stop the looming humanitarian crisis.
Nous allons pratiquement doubler dès maintenant notre aide humanitaire. Nous
avions. He says at the beginning of this financial year, they budgeted some $4 million, but have to double it to nearly $8 million, which he considers still insufficient to meet the growing humanitarian needs of the refugees. Broer says last year, the European Union assisted them with about $11 million. As Cameroon, the United Nations and the international community struggle to attend to the growing needs of the displaced persons and refugees, some Nigerian kids, who constitute the majority of refugees at the Minawau camp, say they want to get an education, just what they are denied by the militant group in their own country. 9-year-old Bijigile James, who has been enrolled in class at the camp, says his dream is to become a medical doctor.
I want something that my teacher can teach me. I want to teach it. If I have learned something, so the people they can say that you are a good boy.
He is nostalgic about his country, Nigeria, and misses the education he had in his hometown, Yerwa. He told me when Boko Haram will give peace a chance, he will return to his lovely country, Nigeria. James sang his country's national anthem as I left.
I want to sing the national anthem.
I rise called O Patriot, Nigeria's called Obey,
Mopki, Edwin Kinzika, VON News, Minawao.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab releases a video calling for attacks on Western shopping malls. And the number of Nigerian refugees fleeing to Cameroon to escape Boko Haram terrorism has doubled within the past month. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. South Sudan's warring parties are meeting once again in Ethiopia for peace talks. Mediators have said this will be the last round of negotiations. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
South Sudan has 10 more days to reach a lasting peace and power-sharing deal. Both the African Union and the East African bloc IGAD have repeatedly threatened South Sudan's factions with sanctions if no comprehensive power-sharing deal is reached by March 5. IGAD's lead mediator, Siu Mesfin, called this round of negotiations the final opportunity for South Sudan.
After months of negotiations, you are all well aware of what must be achieved now. Genuine compromise and dialogue must take place. The agreed March 5 deadline to conclude negotiations must be respected so that the pre-transitional period can begin on April 1 and the transitional government of national unity formed no later than July 9 of this year.
Other items on the agenda for this round of talks, besides establishing the transitional government of national unity, are security, economy, justice, and humanitarian affairs. There's also a committee dealing with leadership and governance issues. Both sides at the start of the talks reaffirmed their commitment to peace. Several deals have been signed since January 2014, including a cessation of hostilities agreement. But IGAD says there are verified reports that both sides have violated the ceasefire agreement. It is expected the United Nations Security Council will consider a resolution on South Sudan this week, including the possibilities of sanctions. South Sudan's Information Minister Michael McQuay says sanctions will only complicate things.
The sanctions will not be doing anything other than adding more suffering to the people of South Sudan. So, calling for sanctions is not a solution, it is a complicating factor. And I'm sure those who call for sanctions are people who are not genuinely wishing South Sudan peace.
The conflict started in December 2013 between soldiers of President Salva Kiir and troops loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The two leaders will face each other again later this week. Their last meeting at the end of the African Union summit in January did not result in any real outcome. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
An Egyptian court sentenced prominent activist Ala Abdel Fattah to 5 years in prison today in charges connected to a law banning protests. The Cairo court also sentenced 24 others to between 3 and 15 years, drawing shouts of "down with military rule" from supporters in the courtroom. Authorities said that in November 2013, Abdel Fattah incited an unauthorized demonstration and assaulted a police officer. An earlier verdict sentenced him to 15 years in prison, but a judge ordered a retrial. He was a leading opposition figure during the 2011 popular uprising that pushed former President Hosni Mubarak from power. The law against protests not authorized by the government went into effect after President Mohamed Morsi was ousted by the military in 2013. Liberia's president says her country needs international help to rebuild roads, power grids, and clean water supplies following the Ebola epidemic. President Alan Johnson Sirleaf made the public appeal while attending a forum in the United Arab Emirates. Mrs. Sirleaf said the nation lacks the funding for preventative health services. Liberia's president plans to carry the same message to Washington on Friday when she meets with President Obama. The U.S. is withdrawing most of its 2,800 troops that helped Liberia reduce the threat of Ebola. The virus has killed more than 9,500 people in West Africa in the past year. More than 23,000 people have been infected. While conditions have greatly improved, the World Health Organization reported last week that the weekly decline in infections in the three countries has stalled. Officials remain concerned about how to reach zero new infections. An official at the U.S. Agency for International Development says more than 10,000 civilian personnel from NGOs and the United Nations remain on the ground fighting to end the outbreak. The World Health Organization is launching a global campaign to stop the use of dirty syringes and needles that are responsible for millions of life-threatening infections each year. The new WHO initiative aims to prevent unsafe injections by promoting so-called smart syringes that cannot be used more than once. Lisa Schlein reports from the campaign's launch at WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Injections are supposed to cure illnesses and save lives, and in most cases they do. But the World Health Organization warns many of the 16 billion injections administered every year spread disabling, often deadly infections because of the reuse of contaminated syringes and needles. WHO reports around 10% of injections used for immunizations and procedures such as blood transfusions and injectable contraceptives are generally safe. The problems lie with the remaining 90% that inject medicine through the muscle or skin. WHO says a great many of these injections are not necessary or could be replaced by oral medication. Worse still, coordinator of WHO's Department of HIV/AIDS, Gunda Oralweiler, warns these injections often are not safe and are driving the spread of deadly infectious diseases worldwide.
We do know that 1.7 million hepatitis B infections are probably attributable to unsafe injections, and more than 300,000 hepatitis C infections every year. So this is a major contribution to the viral hepatitis epidemics. In 2000, there was an estimate that around 10% of new HIV infections were attributable to unsafe injection. Now, for 2010, this has been reduced to less than 1%. Okay. So there is a clear reduction of HIV transmission attributable to unsafe injection, also due to the promotion of safe injection policies.
Despite this progress, Dr. Weiler notes an estimated 33,800 people a year still are contracting HIV through unsafe injections. He says deadly infections are transmitted when a dirty syringe or needle is used on more than one person. Such risks mainly exist in developing countries, but unsafe injections occur all over the world. WHO says the solution for millions of people in rich and poor countries alike is the same. It says millions of people could be protected from infectious diseases by switching to new smart syringes that can be used only once. Several models are available. One causes the plunger to break after the injection. Other models have a metal clip that blocks the plunger from moving back or a needle that retracts into the syringe barrel at the end of the injection. Lisa Hedman in WHO's Department of Essential Medicines and Health Products says WHO is not recommending any particular device because not all injections are the same. She says different devices are needed for different applications.
There are a number of technologies out there, and the reason for that is, in fact, that there isn't really a one-size-fits-all solution, but it's really a broad category of saying, let's bring safety to all of the devices that are out there to make sure that they can't be reused and that they are, you know, fit for the purpose that they were intended.
Previous WHO-led injection safety campaigns between 2000 and 2010 have made considerable progress. They have resulted in a sevenfold decrease in the reuse of injection devices in developing countries. The goal of this new initiative is to get all countries to exclusively use the new smart syringes by 2020, except in a few special circumstances. WHO is calling on manufacturers to beef up production of these devices. Syringes without safety features cost 3 to 4 cents each in developing countries. The new smart syringes cost at least twice that much, but WHO believes the price will go down as demand increases. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Zimbabwe's finance minister has appealed to visiting African Development Bank executives for debt relief in an effort to boost the country's ailing economy. Sebastian Momfu has more from Harare.
Zimbabwe Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa made the appeal Monday to an AFDB team visiting Zimbabwe and Mozambique. Chinamasa says the Zimbabwean government hopes if the AFDB cancels its debt, other organizations such as the IMF and the World Bank will do the same.
In our meeting, I emphasized that the African Development Bank should play a leading role in securing clearance of arrears that we've accumulated with the multilateral creditors. So I've tried to appeal to the bank. I'm aware that they've done it with respect to other countries, and my appeal to them is that they should bend over backwards to assist us so that we become part of the global economy.
Zimbabwe has an external debt of nearly $10 billion, which it has been accruing since 2000. About $500 million is owed to the African Development Bank. Last year, the International Monetary Fund said Zimbabwe did not qualify for debt relief under the heavily indebted Poor Countries Initiative because the Southern African nation is not poor enough. The initiative has been used in countries like Zambia to settle debt. 10 executives of African Development Bank are visiting Zimbabwe and Mozambique to assess progress of already financed projects. They are expected to meet Friday with President Robert Mugabe. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
This is African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab releases a video calling for attacks on Western shopping malls. The number of Nigerian refugees fleeing to Cameroon to escape Boko Haram terrorism has doubled within the past month. And South Sudan's warring parties are meeting once again in Ethiopia for peace talks. Coming up, music from Burundi, and in our feature segment, the challenges of power generation and supply across Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA Sports, which Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sonny, I understand you're beginning with the Cricket World Cup.
Yehiz, England defeated neighbor Scotland by 119 runs Monday for its first victory at the Cricket World Cup. The match was played at Hagley Oval in Christchurch, New Zealand, which is co-hosting the 14-nation cricket extravaganza with Australia. The final score from Hagley Oval: England 303 for 8 in 50 overs, Scotland 184 for 42.2 overs. The man of the match was left-handed batsman Moeen Ali, who scored 128 runs for England. England's win over Scotland followed losses to co-hosts New Zealand and Australia. Scotland, meanwhile, lost to New Zealand by 3 wickets in its opening match. In action Sunday at the Cricket World Cup, the Proteas of South Africa lost to India by 130 runs in Melbourne, Australia. It was a humiliating defeat for South Africa, so says team captain A.B. de Villiers.
It's a big knock for us, you know, to get beaten by 130 runs. It's almost embarrassing. You never want to lose by that amount of runs. You always want to be a competitive team. Feel like you're always in the game. You've got a chance to win games. Just not our day, I'd say. It's difficult to put it down to exactly where we went wrong. Quite a few areas where we just didn't play as well as we wanted to. Started pretty slow with the ball in hand. Difficult to make breakthroughs throughout the day. And at the end of the day, I thought it was probably a 275, 280 par kind of wicket. We actually did well to keep them down to 307. And I felt we had a chance halfway through the game, but unfortunately just lost our way completely with a bat in hand.
South Africa's cricket captain says the Proteas will now try to regroup ahead of their next match.
We'll have to start strategizing on how we're going to recover and regroup as a unit, and we'll put all our focus on Friday against the West Indies. It's a big game for us, and it's a must win in Sydney.
Meanwhile, before the West Indies plays South Africa in Sydney, the Windies will challenge Zimbabwe on Tuesday in Canberra, Australia's capital. The West Indies has 1 win and 1 loss, the same record held by the Chevrons from Zimbabwe. Taking a look at the Pool B table, India leads after Sunday's big victory over South Africa. India has the maximum 4 points from 2 matches. The West Indies is next, followed by Ireland, Zimbabwe, and South Africa, which all have 2 points. The United Arab Emirates and Pakistan are at the bottom with no points. Turning to African club football, Anton Satif of Algeria is the 2015 African Super Cup champion. The VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shagun Dot on the Spot Adeyemi, reports.
Good evening, Africa. Algerian football club Anton Satif has won the African Super Cup. Anton Satif became the first Algerian club to win the Super Cup after beating Egyptian giant Al Ahly in a dramatic penalty shootout on Saturday in Blida, Algeria. The one-off match between the African Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup winners ended in a dramatic fashion as Emad Mutiab scored 4 minutes into stoppage time to equalize 1-1 for Al Ahly. But Setif survived the nail-biting finale to triumph 6-5 on penalties, converting all of its kicks before fullback Bassem Ali missed for Ali. Setif, winner of the 2014 Champions League on the away goals rule, had taken the lead at the Mustafa Cheka Stadium after 70 minutes through Abdimalik Ziyaya. Ali is a six-time winner of the CAF Super Cup, including the last two editions. It was the first time since 1994 that Ali has tasted defeat in the CAF Super Cup. 21 years ago, the Red Devils lost to bitter rival Zamalek in the 1994 edition held in Johannesburg, South Africa. CAF President Issa Hayatou, assisted by Algerian Minister of Youth and Sports Mohamed Tami, presented the giant trophy to ES Setif captain Melouli amid cheers from the ecstatic crowd. In addition to the trophy, the Black Eagles, as ES Setif is known, also got $75,000 in cash prize. Reacting to the victory, ES Setif coach Kredim Madui hailed his club's triumph, saying it was at the better side of luck. Madui, who has joined the rare list of coaches to have won both the CAF Champions League and the CAF Super Cup, said, "I'm proud to win this title. Ali gave us problems, but that did not stop us from believing. It was a tough match against a strong opponent. We know penalties depend hugely on luck, and we were lucky in the end." The coach hailed goalkeeper Kedaria, calling him the ES Setif's savior. With the CAF Super Cup taking the club's trophy haul to 23 titles, Madui finally declared that ES Setif has now joined the elite class of African football. Reacting to his team's loss, Al Ahly coach Juan Carlos Garrido absolved his players of blame. "We were better in almost all aspects of the game, made good passes, and better in possession. Even when we were behind, we came back strongly and equalized," Garrido said at the post-match press conference. "We missed many chances that could have secured the match for us. ES Setif's goal was by chance. I cannot blame my players. They did a great job." Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Yes, my friend.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Just ahead on the Sunny Side of Sports, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on a basketball great who celebrated his 64th birthday on Sunday.
Yesterday is Sunday, 1950. Basketball star Julius Winfield Irving was born in Hempstead, New York. His acrobatic moves on the court won him the nickname Dr. J. His career as an NBA player began in 1976 with the Philadelphia 76ers and lasted until 1987. During that time, Dr. J led the 76ers to the NBA Finals four times and won the championship in 1983. He was also an All-NBA first team selection five times and averaged about 22 points per game.
We're tired of beating our head against the wall and working with someone else.
More on Dr. J, who celebrated his 64th birthday on Sunday. Our VOA basketball fans might be interested to know that Dr. J does, in fact, hold an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Massachusetts, where he played in college. Having left college early to pursue a professional basketball career, Dr. J returned to the University of Massachusetts and earned a bachelor's degree in 1986 in creative leadership and administration, fulfilling a promise he had made to his mother. And while Dr. J's NBA career, as James Buddy mentioned, began in 1976 with the Philadelphia 76ers, his professional basketball career began in 1971 with the Virginia Squires in the now defunct American Basketball Association. And yes, this 54-year-old youngster has fond memories of my dad bringing me to the Norfolk Scope Arena, where I watched Dr. J make his first professional house calls with the Virginia Squires. In more basketball news, All-Star Kevin Durant of the Oklahoma City Thunder had surgery Sunday to alleviate pain in his right foot. The Thunder does expect Durant to return during the regular season. Oklahoma City's general manager, Sam Presti, says a screw was replaced from Durant's October operation for a broken bone in his left foot. Kevin Durant has been hobbled much of this season. He's played in just 27 games because of the broken foot, a sprained right ankle, and a sprained left big toe. Durant is the second All-Star in recent days to be sidelined. Chris Bosh of the Miami Heat will miss the rest of the NBA season because of blood clots on his lungs. Finally, Michael Phelps has taken the plunge and gotten engaged. The 18-time Olympic gold medalist announced on Twitter that he's marrying Nicole Johnson, who was Miss California in 2010 and has dated the swimmer on and off the past few years. The engagement comes as the 29-year-old Phelps is finishing a six-month suspension from USA Swimming for his second drunken driving arrest. The suspension ends on March 6th. Michael Phelps, the gold medalist, engaged to be married. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yehias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the challenges of power generation and supply across Africa. And next, false rumors about the Ebola vaccine for school children in Guinea. But first, some music. Here is Kidumu Burundi with Abambuzi.
Om Dafer, Gango Yusufu Matoma, Yahya Hussein, Papa Grace, Charles Ogada. Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, c'est ça. Mama Kibido, Maurice Oyano. Todie, Todie.
Pamoa sama si joro. Pamoa wisera. Kandi wachi wa mamako. Te wakensi na mungu sama. Bituma kensi niki ya babu. Tamarongo mesi. Ineka bizosa ya mpamuwa. Uga sigara widoga wichuza. Kwesi yomenya kanura mushinga nage. Kanura mufasoni. Iisi siwe nyikishi. Abanu bundi batifina. Abambuzi tabara bose. Tera kesu titekwe.
Aukurina bambuzi.
Papa grasa.
Wami maso bambuzi na mitunda jawe.
Kariyo kinomo.
Umera makabano jambo mokondo razasi.
Wirinde.
Wirinde. Wirinda bambuzi.
Bambuzi, bambuzi.
Wirinde. Wirinda basura, basura, basura.
Kwa
kabiria kuya
muze wigeru ya yata
mutko hawe ni mana
muze wigeru tachachako
umbiri sanchuti anje umukishu tangwa ni mana babambuzi basa kwisi naka ibaruse nyanzuki busa ulivyo rera roja mungu kondo razosi Kabiso saya pre ikute kyakuye kanura musinga naye kanura mufasoni yisi siminyigise abanobo bakina abamuzika barabafise abutera tesuti tekuye
ukurinda abamuzi
akataretse kabagasema
wame maso musika mitunda kyawe
kandi kabiri karatiko
mera makaba mujambo pokono rasisi
era hezo mwibuza
wirinde wirinda abamuzi
aho
wirinde wirinda basura basura basura
imitwe kirarira
Duma Burundi with a bambuzi. Power outages are a fact of life across much of Africa, with the near-daily blackouts affecting rich and poor countries alike. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports on the challenges of power generation and supply across the continent and what it is being done to keep the lights on.
A small business in Nairobi that began as a party supply outfit has expanded to serve restaurants and supermarkets, moving more than a ton of ice a day, while their custom-made ice sculptures decorate state house events. It's an entrepreneurial success story, but Betty Mbite, office manager of the Iceman Company, says the limits of the country's power supply puts the business in jeopardy.
Sometime last year, when we had about 3 days without power and we couldn't operate at all, yes, because the machines need power, the cold room needs power, and no one can go on without any power.
To keep their swans cold and to keep their customers happy, the Iceman needs a 24-hour supply of power. But relying on Kenya's grid is proving costly, says Mbite.
It is a difficult business, especially if the power is high, because everything you make goes to the power. Yes, wow. We pay back to the government for power.
The number one cost for this business is power. No power, no ice. But the problem is in Kenya and across much of Africa is that power is often inaccessible, expensive, and inconsistent. So the continent's leaders are trying to find ways to make power more accessible so that the business environment can heat up.
Africa is facing enormous power challenges. Some 600 million Africans have no access to electricity at all. That's 60% of the population. Africa consumes less power than any other region in the world, but pays nearly the same average tariffs as the United States and about twice as much as East Asia. Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this year, African Development Bank President Donald Kaburuka said energy shortages are holding countries back.
At this moment, every single African country is experiencing energy shortages and power outages. That is costing the continent 2% of the GDP. In fact, an African leader says that we are a continent of miracles. If we are growing at 5% without enough electricity, think of what we could do if we had enough electricity.
The African Development Bank says weak infrastructure is the biggest challenge to electricity distribution. Even richer nations like South Africa and Nigeria have fallen behind because of a lack of investment in power generation. While each nation presents its own challenges, Kaburuka says increasing the trade of energy across borders may help to create more consistent supplies and bring down prices.
It is not possible for our individual 54 countries to have energy security from their own domestic resources. We have to create viable regional markets for power, and that is possible.
Investors are pouring money into renewable energy projects in Africa to help lessen the energy gap, but much more is needed. Africa's booming population, expected to double by 2050, will continue to put pressure on power supplies, and failure to improve generation could mean a lot of lost opportunity. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Guinean government is trying to stem growing panic over false rumors that the Red Cross will begin administering an Ebola vaccine to school children. Parents have taken their children out of school, and angry youth have attacked health workers. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry.
The Guinean government says there are no plans for the Red Cross or anyone else to launch an Ebola vaccine campaign in schools. Health Minister Colonel Remy Lama told VOA the rumors are baseless and we are started by people who want to sabotage the fight against Ebola.
Il n'a jamais été question ni de pulvériser ni de vacciner dans une école. Et mieux,
he says the Red Cross could not be able to embark on a vaccination campaign on its own without the cooperation of the health ministry. He says any such campaign could be preceded by a large education and an awareness campaign because people are worried that they could catch Ebola through a vaccination. State television Saturday night showed a man accused by the authorities of spreading the false rumor. Police say the man will soon appear before a judge. The vaccination rumor has spread like wildfire in the past week. Parents scrambled to collect their children from schools around the country. Schools in Kenya and Bokke, large cities in the west of the country, were shut Wednesday and Thursday because of threats from students and parents. On Friday in Farana in Upper Guinea, hungry students attacked and destroyed a transit center of Ebola patient and set fire to a vehicle belonging to Doctors Without Borders. Two of its workers narrowly escaped lynching by the angry student. The health minister says the government is working hard to keep students safe from Ebola.
Le gouvernement a pris toutes les mesures qu'il faille pour pouvoir apporter un démenti à cette fausse rumeur par la sensibilisation.
Lama says the government is involving parents in an awareness campaign it has launched in schools to refute the rumor. He said the authorities are working to keep schools safe. Students must wash hands before classes, and foreign visitors have been banned from school grounds. He said today students are more protected in schools than on the street and in their homes. The wave of panic reflects continued misinformation and resistance to Ebola interventions in Guinea, where this regional epidemic began more than a year ago. The Red Cross says members of its staff in Guinea are being attacked on average 10 times per month. Health authorities have reported such as a threefold increase in infection rate since January, which they blame on people refusing to cooperate with contact tracing. The government says it is working to eradicate Ebola by the end of February, the goal it set at the start of the year. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The rise of violent extremism is a test of international law and of the global world order that arose from the chaos and brutality of the Second World War, an order that the civilized world has built and defended for the past 70 years. Every single week brings new examples of how far the evil of these extremist groups reaches, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Consider Tariq A. Taliban's attack on a school in Peshawar, Pakistan, that resulted in the deaths of 141 people, including 132 children. Boko Haram's attacks against civilians in Nigeria, Chad, and Cameroon, which have cost tens of thousands of lives since 2011. And the brutality with which Daesh treats its captives, including crucifying children, selling them as slaves, forcing women into sexual slavery, and handpicking mentally challenged children to serve as suicide bombers. This is what we are up against, said Secretary Kerry. The world cannot and will not cower in the face of this extremism, and the United States and our European partners are helping to lead the fight to defeat it wherever it exists. Today, the coalition fighting Daesh has over 60 active members, and it is succeeding in its stated goal to degrade and destroy Daesh. It has launched some 2,000 airstrikes, retaken around 700 square kilometers of territory, deprived Daesh of the use of 200 oil and gas facilities that they were using to obtain revenue, and forced them to change their tactics. But this is just the beginning, said Secretary Kerry. In the future, the international community must adopt laws that crack down on terrorist recruitment, address the lack of tolerance, inclusivity, and economic opportunity in some societies, and create alternatives to violent extremism in countries where it is prevalent, said Secretary Kerry. The tests that we face today compel us to prepare and plan, to unite and to insist that our collective future will be uncompromised by the primitive and paranoid ideas of terrorists and thugs, but instead will be built by the universal values of decency and civility and knowledge and reason and rule of law. That is what we stand for together, and I am confident about the future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butter here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting February 2nd, we'll begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African-American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. We will select a winner each morning from among the correct answers.